Dr. Paul Frankl joins us now, a medical doctor in private practice in Gauteng and author of a real plea from the heart for the authorities to think again about ivermectin and allowing individual doctors whose belief is that ivermectin might help in the treatment of a particular patient that they be allowed to consider doing so. And Paul, a very good afternoon. That has happened. We don't know exactly how it's going to work, but we know from announcements earlier today that the Health Products Regulatory Authority is going to consider individual requests from individual doctors to use ivermectin in certain cases. So that's very much a step forward. And one, having read your piece, you would very much welcome.
Yes, it's a great step forward. And I really hope and pray that they make it easy for patients to access that it becomes a simple web portal or something rather than piles of forms. But I attended their virtual conference at 1 o'clock and was very impressed by their compassion and their understanding of the situation. It's really good to see that we have people like that on it as well.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask you whether you've used ivermectin in treating a patient because I don't want you to have to to either lie to me or acknowledge that you did something which was against the regulations. But I know because I number several doctors in my acquaintanceship that it's been very, very difficult for them because they've been confronted by situations where they thought there was a reasonable chance that ivermectin would make a difference. And then they either had to do it against the prevailing regulations or not do it at all. And it's been a very, very difficult process for a lot of individual treatment doctors to navigate.
Yes, and it places you really at a crux of an ethical dilemma. You have a patient who needs help, and at the same time, you can't legally give them help. What's interesting is patients can choose to take whatever they want to, and some do, and those that have taken it, I've seen really impressive results.
But you don't know whether those impressive results were because of ivermectin or because of the natural passage of the viral material out of their bodies or because of some other part of the treatment protocol with which they were engaged.
Correct. Unless you have a control group, it's difficult to say with authority and convincing authority that that is the reason. But when you see a change happening in 6 to 8 hours, it's fairly convincing when oxygen saturations start to climb by 7 to 10%.
So you're reasonably convinced as an individual medical practitioner that ivermectin can and often does make a significant difference to recovery from COVID symptoms.
So I think if one looks at the statistics and one looks at the research, it's fairly convincing. I mean, while Andrew Hill says the data is provisional, he was asked, what does he think? And he said, well, and I quoted it in the article, the chance of all of this being by chance with ivermectin not working and still giving all these positive results is 1 in 5,000. That's a very small chance. That's a lottery ticket I'd like, actually. So the data is certainly very, very encouraging. I think what's also encouraging in the literature is that there seems to be a dose response as well. So on the lower doses or single doses, patients aren't getting better. But as the doses get higher, your percentage affecting mortality starts to climb all the way to the highest dose for 5 days in an Egyptian trial, goes to a 99% drop in mortality compared to the control group. So that together, the two instances of it really helps. The last Lancet trial that came through, it says on a single dose we had no effect on mortality, but what they say right at the end is we had a significant effect on the time it took for people's smell to come back, halved in the ivermectin group, even though it was a single dose. So you're seeing low doses affecting things like the length to recovery of smell, and you're seeing higher doses. As you start giving higher doses for longer, you're getting higher drops in mortality. That's quite convincing to me as a clinician and as a scientist.
And look,
it's provisional.
Yeah.
Again, the data is provisional, but everything's provisional now. We don't have anything definitive.
Yeah, we did, just to let listeners know, the Andrew Hill you mentioned is a professor from Liverpool University, and he is responsible for the meta-analysis of the studies which had been done, which indicate probably high levels of efficacy of this drug. And we have invited him on the radio, but he said he's not doing interviews for a while because he's busy preparing results for a regulatory review of ivermectin. But I don't want to put you in a position where you have to, you know, attack the Health Products Regulatory Authority, but I get a lot of communication from medical people and non-medical people, lay people, who are very angry with SAHPRA for not having reacted more quickly, not having been more proactive, not having issued a sort of generalized Section 21 exemption for the use of ivermectin for any doctor who wants to use it or any patient who wants to use it. But you seem, from the article that I read this morning, Paul, to have some understanding of their hesitancy on this.
Well, I think they're responsible for large public health interventions. We're responsible for the patient that's in front of us. And there could be a way to meet, and I think what they've done with the compassionate use is a way to meet the needs of both. They've obviously had a bigger experience with lots and lots of drugs. I think the hydroxychloroquine story is one of them, where it all looked very hopeful and turned into a big mess. But I think the data here is far, far more convincing than it is in hydroxychloroquine. If anyone wants to see, there's a wonderful set of graphics up on the frontline COVID care physicians website where they show some trials worked with hydroxychloroquine, some didn't. But if you look at everything they've done for ivermectin, everything is on the side of it worked and it had a statistical significance. So I think they need to look at that, and I think they have. One of the things I don't understand, and it's a bureaucratic issue, I guess, is why they don't just register it for scabies or for one of the other parasites where we know it works and it's safe to use and it's been used hundreds of millions of times around the world, and just let doctors use it. But I guess they need to follow their path.
Yeah, I mean, the first interview that I did about this was some weeks ago now with Jeremy Nell, Dr. Jeremy Nell, who's on the subcommittee of the MRC, which looks at medicines and medicine uses. And he said that, yeah, but it's just that none of the trials are convincing in and of themselves, because almost everyone you can attack on the basis of too small a number of patients in the study, poorly designed, not controlled enough for other treatment options that were being used at the same time as ivermectin. And I mean, essentially, in a slightly more guarded way, that's what Andrew Hill's meta-analysis kind of said as well.
Yes, it does. But again, that's the data we have at the moment. Yeah. And weighing that up against the potential for harm versus the potential for good, and what clinicians all over the world are reporting with its use, including clinicians in Peru and India, where they have rolled it out on a mass scale, and you can see the drop in mortality in those particular states where it has been rolled out. It's fairly convincing. At least it's convincing enough for off-label use, provided it's safe. And of course, it's always with the ethical provision, provided it's safe, provided you do no harm.
And as a preventative,
what Andrew Hill says as well.
Carry
on.
I was going to ask about ivermectin, what the data are around its use as a preventative, because that again anecdotally is something that is happening a lot. People are taking a couple of slicks of ivermectin a day and going, well, then I'm immune, and wandering around without a mask and not continuing to adhere to these non-pharmaceutical interventions. From your reading of the data that are out there, is there any credible evidence that it works as a preventative measure?
So just to address the behavior, firstly, it's unacceptable to think you're protected. You need to protect others, wear the masks, and do all the non-pharmaceutical things to keep people safe. That goes without question. I think when you look at the data, it certainly is tending towards showing almost a very high efficacy in some of the trials up to the mid 80%, which is only around 10% less than the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines are talking about. And that being said, there's a danger in mass, so to speak, slicking of ivermectin, because one worries about increasing viral resistance. If we've got a drug that works, you want to make sure it continues to work. It's got to be done safely with proper protocols.
Because, again, anecdotally, vet shops around Cape Town don't have any left because people are coming in saying, my dog needs ivermectin. Can I have as much as you got? Because he's a big dog and he's very sick. So people are taking it on the basis of what social media tells them. And one of the questions I asked Jeremy Nell in my very first interview was, what are the risks? I mean, if this is something which could work but could also potentially do a great deal of harm, then one needs to be more cautious. But if it's something that probably might work, and you know what, the side effects are relatively low and overdosing is not something which is a huge issue, then why not allow it to be done? But we just don't know how much people are taking as a preventative, as a prophylactic.
So again, the SL-CCC gives you a dosage and a regimen which is really well documented according to the literature that is available. It seems to change fairly regularly in terms of the frequency of use as more data comes out. Again, this is an evolving field. But the dangers are, one, of the individual side effects and the potential of individual side effects, and the other dangers of what happens to the public. So if we address what happens to the public, behaviors start to change, people start thinking they're immune, and disease gets spread. The other side of it on a public health side is, if people are taking it inappropriately, there's the risk of, if it does work, that one gets resistance and then it stops working, and then those who are sick are left with nothing, right? On the very specific side effect, it's a well-tolerated drug. It can give rashes, it can affect the liver, nothing outside of a normal sort of package insert. The big risk is that if it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it can cause seizures, but that happens when there's a very rare genetic defect that some people carry, extremely rare, and that too seems to be reversible. So on the side effect profile, well tolerated, probably equivalent to most of the other drugs that we use daily, without giving a lot of thought to it, or being so scared to use. We always want to give thought to the side effect profiles, but those.
So you're going to be preparing your compassionate applications just as soon as you know what you have to do.
Absolutely, there's no question about it. And what I implore SAHPRA, that they don't take 2 weeks to answer it; that it comes through within sort of hours of application.
Dr. Paul Frankl, thank you very, very much for talking to us this afternoon, medical doctor in private practice. And if you're interested in accessing more of his thinking around this, there is an op-ed piece by him on the Daily Maverick website.